Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. Purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together. In other words, to address problems and issues rather than defend positions. Well, today we're in for something completely different. While we think of politics as very this-worldly, this week we're going to go explore the otherworldly domain of near-death experiences and their implications for how we perceive life and death and how we conduct ourselves in this world. Now, this is a bit of a personal issue for me. When I was 8 years old, my dad suffered a near-fatal heart attack, and afterward he reported what now would be termed a near-death experience. While he was unconscious, his sister Betty, who had passed just a month earlier, called to him from across a bridge. And for some reason, possibly because he had two young boys to take care of, he declined the invitation to join her and return to this world. He lived another 18 years, long enough to see his boys grown up and on their way to fulfilling lives. But as a boy, I continued to read about these experiences in Reader's Digest, probably the only publication in the 50s and 60s that would give the experience any kind of credence. Well, anyway, fast forward to around 1980, when I was teaching a creative writing class for the University of Michigan Adult Education. One of my students was Dr. Bruce Grayson, who was at that time the emergency room psychiatrist at the University of Michigan Hospital. He was working on a story for my class with a metaphysical theme. And one week when he was out of town, I was very surprised to receive an installment from him in the mail in an envelope that was marked University of Virginia, Department of Parapsychology. Well, needless to say, I was intrigued. When he returned, I asked him about it. I remember that he looked around to make sure that I was the only one that could hear him. And then he told me he did his psychiatric residency working with Ian Stevenson, who was investigating children who remembered past life experiences. Well, in any case, Bruce and I have stayed connected over the years, and he's made the study of near-death experiences his life work. As a scientist without a religious belief system, he's been relentless in seeking some physical explanation for the anecdotal data he received from patients who had vivid memories of what transpired when their brains were, quote-unquote, dead. These individuals quite often knew things they had no business knowing, including, in some cases, the awareness of loved ones who died while they themselves were unconscious, right? Do these inexplicable experiences that defy linear logic and scientific dogma have implications for the awakening needed to transform our political New World situation? I say they do. Our guest today is Bruce Grayson. He's professor emeritus of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at University of Virginia. He's the author of a new book called After: A Doctor Explores What Near-Death Experiences Reveal About Life and Beyond. He is also co-author of Irreducible Mind and co-editor of the Handbook of Near-Death Experiences. He's written many journal articles given many media interviews, and has been called the father of research in near-death experiences. So welcome, Bruce.
Oh, thanks, Steve. I'm so happy to be talking to you again.
Me too. First, I want to check in with you regarding the accuracy of what I remember. Did I get that right?
Your memory is as bad as mine is. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, nothing like agreement. You know, you can make me tell you that.
Right.
Well, since the focus of this book, your book, is on near-death experiences, you just mentioned briefly in the book your work with Ian Stevenson, but I remember I've held this as a source of fascination ever since I met you probably 40 years ago. I do remember you telling a story about working with Ian Stevenson, who was working with children who remembered past life experiences. And I remember that you had a story of at least one young boy who you took to see his family home. And sure enough, his memories, past life memories, matched the reality of corroborated. Could you say a little bit about that?
Sure. This was one of the more than 2,000 cases that Ian Stevenson had collected. And this one happened to be in Virginia, where we were living at the time. There was a boy about 3 years old, born to a family who ran a health food store. And this boy, unlike the family, kept wanting to eat red meat, and the family were vegetarians. He wanted to wear cowboy boots instead of the running shoes they all wore. Didn't fit into their home life at all. And when he got more language skills, he started talking at age 3 or so about having died in a motorcycle accident. And they thought he was making this up, and they just kept trying to tell him to stop making stories up, but he kept persisting. And then one time when he was about 4 years old, his mother was driving him somewhere. He was in the car seat. And he very excitedly started pointing out the window and said, "That's my house. That's my house." So she stopped the car because he was so insistent and looked up, and there was an old white frame house up on a hill. And she said, "You mean that house?" And he said, "Well, yeah, but it didn't used to have a porch on it. And there was a shed in the back." She didn't know what to make of this. So she just drove on home, much to his dismay. He was kind of screaming, "No, go back. And that evening she told her husband about it. And he said, "You know, we got to look into this. So they contacted the family that lived there. And they said they only lived there for a couple of years, and they didn't know who lived there before. So they asked around the neighbors, and they found out that there used to be a family there who had a teenage boy who, in fact, used to go behind the shed in the back to smoke, which didn't exist anymore. The shed didn't exist. And the boy had unfortunately died in a motorcycle accident. And at that point, the family left. And they didn't know where they had gone. So there's no further way of corroborating any other events. But this is typical of the kind of stories that Ian was collecting. Children, very young, preschool kids, who would talk about a past life and often have likes and dislikes that conform to the past life and didn't conform to the present family, and then had concrete facts about the life that they lived before that turned out to be corroborated.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I remember that I remember a story like that you told me back there when I was teaching my writing class. Yeah. And I asked you, I said, "Bruce, does this represent reincarnation? Is it the collective unconscious?" And I remember what you said. You said, "Look, I'm a scientist. I'm only collecting the data. I cannot make any conclusions about this." And as I read your wonderful book on near-death experiences, I see that scientist perspective has persisted as you've done everything you can to rule out any kind of physical explanation for so how what has it been like walking the line between science and metaphysics as a doctor, as a scientist, looking around you at University of Michigan to make sure that nobody overheard you talking about Ian Stevenson?
Yeah.
What has it been like to actually walk that line?
Well, I didn't feel like I was walking a line because I was totally in the scientific side of it. I have no background in metaphysics or philosophy or theology. So I considered myself a scientist. And I was confronted by these phenomena of people who claim to have died and sometimes had their heart stopped and yet have vivid memories of that period in between when they were unconscious. And as a scientist, I couldn't say, no, this doesn't really exist. I'm not going to pay attention to it. I thought it was my obligation to try to look into it and understand it. And in fact, at one point, my supervisors at Michigan said, you got to cut this out. This is ridiculous. If you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. So you need to stop looking at these silly things. And that just seemed intellectually dishonest to me. So I ended up at that point leaving Michigan and going to greener pastures where they valued the research I was doing and the work I was doing.
That's really interesting. You begin the book with a story, and it's a really very compelling story that happened before you had any interest or knowledge or awareness about near-death experience. And it happened when you were doing your initial residency at an emergency room also, it sounds like, at I believe it was probably in Charlottesville.
Yes, it was.
And you had a young patient, Holly, who had attempted suicide. Tell us a little bit about that. What happened?
Right. Well, you know, as I said, I'd grown up in a scientific household. There was never any talk about anything spiritual or non-physical. You know, we just thought the physical world was all there is. When you die, that's the end of it, and that was fine. And then a few weeks into my internship, you know, I was green, I didn't know what I was doing. I got paged to go see a patient in the emergency room who had overdosed. And I was in the cafeteria eating my dinner when the pager went off, scared the dickens out of me, and I dropped my fork and spilled some spaghetti sauce on my tie. So I tried to wipe it off, couldn't do it. So I put on a lab coat over that and buttoned it up so you couldn't see the spaghetti sauce. And I answered the page, and there was a patient waiting to be seen, so I went down to the emergency room to see her. And it turned out she was totally unconscious. I could not arouse her no matter what I did. However, her roommate, who had brought her in, was waiting down the hall to talk to me. So I went down to see the roommate, got information from the roommate about what was going on in the patient's life, what she might have taken, and so forth. It was a very hot Virginia evening at the end of the summer. I was sweating. There was no air conditioning back in the 1970. So I unbuttoned my lab coat so I wouldn't sweat so much, inadvertently exposing that stain on my tie for about 10 minutes or so. When I got up to say goodbye to her and send her home, I realized it was exposed, so I buttoned it up again so the ER staff wouldn't see this. Then I went back to see the patient, who was still unconscious. She was admitted to the ICU overnight, and I saw her the next morning after she awoke. When I saw her the next morning, I introduced myself, and she said, I know who you are. I remember you from last night. That kind of stunned me, so I kind of said to her, I'm surprised. I thought you couldn't see me last night because you were asleep. And she said, not in my room. I saw you talking to my roommate. That just blew me away. I couldn't imagine what she was talking about. So she saw I was confused, and then she started to tell me about what was going on in the room with her roommate. My questions, the roommate's answers, where we were sitting, what we were wearing. And then for the clincher, she told me about the spaghetti stain on my tie. There's no way she could have known that. I just couldn't imagine what's going on here. I thought, they're playing a trick on me somehow. The nursing staff had gotten together with her and included this. It didn't make any sense. So I kind of pushed it out of my mind and tried to deal, because I had to deal with her confusion. I couldn't deal with mine. She was there as a suicidal patient. So I kind of pushed it out of my mind for several years and tried not to think about it. I didn't dare tell anyone about it. They'd think I was crazy. Mm-hmm. And then about 4 or 5 years later, Raymond Moody wrote a book called Life After Life, in which he gave us the term near-death experience and described what they were. And I realized for the first time what this patient had told me was not just one isolated incident, but part of a huge phenomenon around the world. I decided at that point, I still couldn't understand it, but I had to find out what it was about. And here, 50 years later, I'm still trying to understand it.
Now, one of the things that many people report is being, quote-unquote, out of their body, or perhaps above their body, or able to see things. There have been people who've talked about being able to see things in surgery while they were in surgery, looking over that, and again, very accurately reporting conversations and things that happen. So apparently that's a fairly common description that people give. For people that don't know or don't know people who've had these or haven't read about them, what are the characteristics of these near-death experiences?
Well, typically people are overwhelmed by a sense of overwhelming peace and well-being. Sometimes they say joy. They feel that they are out of their bodies. They sometimes look down and see their bodies. They may go through a tunnel to some other realm where they may see other entities. They may identify them as deceased loved ones or as deities or other divine beings. And they may review their entire lives. And then at some point, they make a decision to come back to life, or they're sent back against their will and find themselves back in their bodies, sometimes very angry about that. But they eventually adjust to it and carry on with their lives. Oh, that's very difficult. And we can talk about that a little later. It's the adjustment to coming back to life is sometimes quite traumatic.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds... I was just watching a video with Dr. Zach Bush, and he was talking about having similar experiences with patients that he brought back from cardiac arrest and so on.
Yes.
And he says to a person, when they came back, their question was, why did you bring me back?
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm sure that there's something compelling. We can talk a little bit more about the different experiences that people have. About what percentage of people who let's say have these kinds of medical emergencies where they either stop breathing or their heart stops or their brain stops. What percentage of people actually report these near-death experiences?
It is between 10 and 20% of people who have documented heart stopping report mm-hmm. near-death experiences. Yeah.
Okay. I wonder what the other ones. And of course, there's varieties. We're going to take a very short break right now, and then we'll be back with Dr. Bruce Grayson talking about the before-death experiences of people who have near-death experiences. We'll be back on WikiPolitiki in a very short few minutes.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
COVID-19, brought to you by CDC and the Ad Council.
If you're feeling increasingly lonely right now, you're not alone. It's totally normal. Even though we may not be able to get together in person, connecting virtually with friends and family still gives you a chance to interact with people and may help raise your spirits. Join a virtual book club, set up group text chats, or online video coffee breaks with coworkers.
Find more self-care and coping tips at coping-19.org.
Well, we're back on WikiPolitiki with our guest today, Dr. Bruce Grayson. We're talking about his book, After, A Doctor Explores What Near-Death Experiences Reveal About Life and Beyond. Well, you know, material medicine, I'm sure this is what you were taught in medical school, insists that the mind is a function of the brain. So how do you explain, I have to say that I just loved reading this book like a mystery story, because you're tracking down every possible way that this can be explained through material medicine. How do you explain the vivid experiences of near-death experiences while the brain is, for all intents and purposes, dead?
Well, that's a great question, Steve. You know, I came into this work as a materialist, expecting to find some mechanism in the brain, some physiological mechanism that would allow these things to happen. And we tested one hypothesis after another: lack of oxygen, drugs given to people, drugs produced by the brain, abnormal electrical activity, and so forth. And each one, although it sounds plausible, when you looked at the data contradicted. So I came to the conclusion, finally, that even though we're told that the brain creates the mind, that all our thoughts are created by the brain, that doesn't really happen in a near-death experience. And in fact, there are other phenomena besides the near-death experience where the association between the brain and the mind seems to break down. It seems surprising at first to think that there's a mind out there, there are thoughts that aren't created by the brain, but the dirty secret of neuroscience is we don't really know how the brain could create a thought. No one has ever come up with a hint of a suggestion of an idea of how a chemical or electrical property in the brain can create a thought or a sensation. We just have no idea. So it's not so surprising that we can't come up with a mechanism, a physiological mechanism. People have been talking about a mind being received by the brain or filtered by the brain since Hippocrates 2,000 years ago. Hippocrates wrote that the brain is the messenger of the mind. And it's kind of like a radio receiver. You've got thousands of radio stations out there. If you listen to all of them at once, you couldn't understand any of them. So you have a tuner in your radio that'll filter out all of them except the one you want to listen to. And the idea is that the brain is sort of the same way. There's all this incredible material out there for the mind to access. But if you try to do that, you wouldn't be able to filter it all. You wouldn't be able to understand it all because it's just too much of a barrage. So the purpose of the brain is to filter out the irrelevant stuff and just let in the stuff that's essential to survival. This shouldn't be surprising because all our senses filter out irrelevant phenomena. Our eyes just let in a small portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. Our ears just let in a small proportion of the frequencies available to us, just the ones that are essential to survival. So the brain, also being an organ that evolved over time, also can filter out those phenomena that are not essential to survival and just let in the ones that are important to finding a mate, finding food, finding shelter, and get rid of all other erroneous stuff like seeing God and seeing deceased loved ones. That's not important to survival.
Yeah, and what's really very, very interesting is that when people describe, over and over again, most of these descriptions are descriptions of feeling a sense of universality and peace, that in some way everything was present for them all the time, and they could not quite translate that into language once they came back from that state.
Right. That's one of the things that makes research into near-death experiences or NDEs difficult, because the experiences almost always say, there are just no words to describe what happened to me. And then I excitedly say, oh, great, tell me about it. So I know I'm forcing them to distort the experience by putting it into words. And they end up using metaphors to describe what happened. And since I know they're using metaphors, I know I can't take what they say as literal descriptions, mm-hmm. just as metaphoric descriptions. And then it makes it difficult to really study this rigorously.
You know, I see a quote from the book, the plural of anecdote is data, you know, that people
right,
kind of
right.
dismiss anecdotal. But sometimes the anecdotal, the stories are very, very, very revealing and create amazing puzzles. Something that really stopped me were you offered at least two accounts of people who had near-death experiences and knowing someone close to them had died while they were in a coma, that they couldn't have possibly have been told that.
Right,
could you share,
right.
There was two stories. Could you tell our listeners about that?
Well, one of my favorites is a 25-year-old technical writer, Jack, who was hospitalized with pneumonia. He had repeated respiratory arrest episodes where he couldn't breathe. And he was hospitalized and had one particular nurse who was his primary nurse about his age named Anita. And she was working with him every day. And at one point she said to him, she's going to be taking a long weekend off, so he'll have other nurses working with her. So he wished her well, sent her off. And over that weekend, when she was gone, he had another respiratory arrest where he had to be resuscitated. And during that arrest, he had a beautiful near-death experience. He found himself in a pastoral scene, and there to his surprise, Anita comes walking towards him. So he does a double take and says, Anita, what are you doing here? And she said, this is where I am now, but you can't stay here. You need to go back. But I want you to tell my parents that I'm sorry that I wrecked the red MGB. And then she turned and walked off. Well, he then awoke back in his body in the hospital bed. And the next nurse who came into his room, he excitedly told her about this vivid near-death experience. She got very upset and quickly left the room. It turned out that his primary nurse, Anita, had taken the weekend off to celebrate her 21st birthday. And her parents had surprised her by giving her a red MGB for her birthday. She got so excited, she hopped in the car, took off down the hill, lost control of the car, and smashed into a telephone pole, dying instantly, shortly before his near-death experience. Now, there was no way he could have known that she died, no way he could have expected to see her or wanted to see her, and certainly no way he could have known how she died, and yet he did. So try to explain that on the basis of some brain mechanism.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, and here you are. I mean, again, I know you, and I know where you're coming from.
Yeah.
How did you deal with hearing something like that? It's one thing for people to say, I reported that I was in heaven and I was surrounded by beautiful, a feeling of God and so on. But to actually report data that is provable, just like the kid who remembered being the guy that died in the motorcycle wreck.
Yes.
How do you process that? What was your reaction when you heard that?
I just got so excited. I'm a scientist and a doctor, and my job is to deal with data, not interpretations, not metaphysics. What do the data show? And then you try to understand what it means. And this is more data. This is what really happened. And if we can't explain it by our current models, then our models are wrong, and we need to change them or at least modify them. So that's the approach I took to this. You know, if there are data out there, that's what we have to stick with.
Well, you know, your position is controversial. Again, I remember the conversation you had with your supervisor at the University of Michigan, who basically said, we don't want to study stuff like this. If we can't, if it doesn't match our models of reality, we don't want to bother studying this. And there's quite a number of other phenomena that are being studied, and the religion of science, which we call scientism, the religion of science has a dogma and heresies and all of that, they have really prevented people like Rupert Sheldrake and Bruce Lipton and Lynn McTaggart and Greg Braden and lots of other congruent researchers from sharing what they know, because the official science doesn't have any way of explaining these phenomena, and therefore they consider it outside of their purview. How have you walked that little tightrope?
Yeah. Well, actually, that's one of the reasons I like being in the medical field, because unlike some other areas of science, doctors are a practical group. They're dealing with patients, and what they want to know is what's going to be important to helping my patient out, not can I understand it. So if you can show them that this is important for them to know about, they want to know more about it. And I'm delighted to say that in the 50 years I've been doing this, the attitude among doctors and scientists in general has changed tremendously. When we first started talking about near-death experiences at the American Medical Association back in 1980, no one has ever heard about these things. Most doctors, I'm sure, felt that we were either making it up or being gullible. A few patients were making up these stories to us. And there'd be polite silence in the audience. And now when we talk at those conferences about NDEs, doctors will stand up in the audience and say, let me tell you about my near-death experience. So it's really changed. I think doctors still have legitimate questions about what causes the experience and what their ultimate meaning is. But there's no doubt anymore that they happen to a great number of their patients, and they have implications for the medical care of those patients. And this is not only in medicine, but I think it's most pronounced in medicine. But there have actually been some surveys done of scientists in the past decade in Scotland, in Belgium, and in Brazil, showing that 50% of scientists surveyed said that they think the mind and the brain are separate things. You wouldn't have gotten that 50 years ago.
Exactly. You know, I'm thinking back to maybe 10 years ago, 9 or 10 years ago, I was visiting a friend who's a scientist. He's a psychologist who works and teaches at a hospital. And he had been very skeptical about all of these things. And he told me, he says, you know, I just read Eben Alexander's book. Mm. And he and his daughter had a long conversation about that. It obviously because Eben Alexander, yeah, I know you've interviewed him for your book.
Yes, yes.
And he interviewed you, as a matter of fact. Because he was a scientist who had this experience, my friend actually had to adjust his own belief system to accommodate that.
Eben Alexander was a neurosurgeon for decades. Mm. He worked at Harvard for a while, but when he had his experience and published it, he got a lot of negative feedback from other neuroscientists who said he made the whole thing up. He wasn't really near death, so forth. And there were some pretty damning things written about him in the popular media, not in scientific journals. So I knew Eben at that point. He came to see me after his near-death experience to try to understand it. And I read some of the stuff that was being written about him, and I decided the only way to resolve this problem of what really happened to him is to look at his medical records, which none of the skeptics, the critics, had ever done. So I got Evan's permission to contact his hospital and get the 600-plus pages of his medical record for that 8-day hospitalization he had. And I made a couple of copies of it, and I went through page after page of this, and then I gave the other two copies to other doctors who also independently went through the entire 600-plus pages and analyzed exactly what was going on with him medically at the time. And our plan was to get together at the end of this procedure and iron out our differences in what we thought happened to him. And it turned out there were no differences at all. The medical record was crystal clear that he was, in fact, as close to dead as you can be. He had had a bizarre bacterial infection of his brain that had a less than 1% chance of survival, and the doctors gave him no chance of ever being functioning again. He had what's called the Glasgow Coma Scale done on him every nursing shift 3 times a day, measuring how his brain was functioning. And during the entire 6 days of his coma, it was an abysmal level, showing virtually no ability to think at all. And yet during that time, when the records documented how impaired he was, he had a very elaborate near-death experience. And in fact, at a couple of times during that week, he described things that happened in his hospital room that were very unexpected. He couldn't have guessed these things. So we can anchor when this near-death experience happened by when these events occurred that he talked about. So we know that he had this very elaborate experience with elaborate thinking and feelings and perceptions when his brain was not functioning at all.
Wow. And I think that's how my friend got turned around on this. By the way, I know this is an odd question, but of everything that you recorded, what was there anything that you found more surprising or most surprising or mind-blowing than other things?
Well, yeah, you got to remember that I'm a psychiatrist, and I make my living by trying to help people change their lives. And it's not easy to do. You know, we work for long hours and weeks and sometimes months and years helping people make fairly modest changes in their lives. And here's an experience that in a matter of seconds or minutes can totally transform someone's attitudes, beliefs, values, personality, and behavior. I know of nothing else that has that kind of power to change people's lives. And it's a consistent pattern. They all lose their fear of death. No matter what they describe as the afterlife, they are no longer afraid of dying after this. They also describe increased spirituality. They're much more compassionate, much more loving, much more altruistic in their behavior, much less concerned with material things, with possessions, power, prestige, fame. And that really causes havoc in their lives. They have to change their careers sometimes. Marriages sometimes break up because of this. But they're very profound changes that last for the rest of their lives. I've talked to people decades after their near-death experience, and it's like the experience happened yesterday in terms of the changes in their lives.
And you also say in the book that these are among the most vivid experiences, vivid memories. I mean, early on, you kind of debunk the idea that somehow these are elaborate fantasies that are dreamlike state. Tell us about the difference between a dreamlike state and the way that these people describe their quote-unquote reality of their experiences.
Yeah, well, you know, we know that all memories are subject to change over time, particularly memories that occur in traumatic situations like coming close to death. But since I've been doing this research for 40 or 50 years now, I have the opportunity to go back and recontact people I interviewed back in 1980 and 1885 and interview them again and compare what they say now about their experience and what they said 40 years ago. And what I found, to my surprise, was there was absolutely no change. The memories have not changed one bit over that time. And there were no other memories that remain that stable over time. Their memories are more vivid, more realistic. They don't change. They have more detail to them. They have more context to them. And the emotions that they bring up are vivid. So in that way, they are very unlike memories of dreams or of fantasies, which don't stay with you over time and get more fuzzy as the years pass. And it's hard to remember a dream that you had 40 years ago. It's hard for me, at least. And yet near-death experiences remain as vivid as they were when they first happened.
You know, this is there's something called significant emotional events. You talk about being a psychiatrist and really and being realistic about what it takes to change. Most people, I now understand why I'm messed up, but I'm still messed up. So these, they're so, good. I now understand that. I can explain to you why I'm a jerk. You know, but but what happened with these people? And when we come back from our break, we'll talk about a little more. That these people have actually made profound changes in their lives. And what's also interesting is that people around them have had to make the changes too. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back for a final segment with Dr. Bruce Grayson, talking about after. Steve Bimmon will be back shortly.
Free your mind with OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. At the Equal Justice Initiative, we believe mass incarceration has to end. There is this presumption of dangerousness and guilt that gets assigned to Black and brown people. We have to confront our history of racial injustice and commit to a new era of truth. There's something better waiting for us, something that feels more like freedom. Truth can inspire change. Please learn more at EJI.org.
Well, we're back with our guest, Dr. Bruce Grayson. We're talking about near-death experiences. I remember once being at an event in Columbus, Ohio, and there was a woman there who had a near-death experience. And she said to me, she says, "I am really, really angry at my parents and my church, because what I found out was totally unlike what I had thought." And then I saw an interesting comment that you made that with people who have had these experiences, there is often an increase in belief in God and a decrease in religiosity. Any insights about that?
Yeah. Near-death experiences almost always say that they're more spiritual after the NDE, but not necessarily more religious. As I said before, they tend to talk in metaphors because there are no words to describe what happened to them. And many people will describe encountering this warm, loving being of light that makes them feel loved and accepted and protected. And if you're talking to a Westerner, you know, from someone from the U.S. or Western Europe, they will say to you something like, I'm going to call it God. But it's not the God I was taught about in church. It's much bigger than that. But I'm using the word God just so you know what I'm talking about. And they will consistently say that the religions they were brought up in and those they've explored are much too narrow, much too limited in how they conceive of both God and what happens after death. So they tend to say that they feel as equally at home in any house of worship of any denomination.
Very, very interesting. Yeah, this portends it kind of gives a window into a much broader perspective than our civilization has. And so tell us more about the afterlife, after these near-death experiences, how this plays out in terms of specific ways people have changed their lives, disruption of relationships, and so on. In fact, I could say my dad, after that experience, I did not sense he had other heart issues. I never had a sense of any fear of death from him.
Yeah, that's the most consistent thing that they say, is that they're no longer afraid of death or dying. And, you know, I'm not a metaphysician, I'm a doctor, and when I hear things like this, I come back to my nuts and bolts of my job, and I think, oh my gosh, this is going to make people suicidal if they hear about this. But I thought, because I'd known lots of people who were contemplating ending their lives, but were deterred because they were afraid of what might happen if they tried that. So I did a study, and I interviewed everyone who's admitted to the hospital with a suicide attempt. And I compared those who had a near-death experience as a result of the suicide attempt with those who didn't. And I followed them up every month for a year. And what I found was that those who had a near-death experience became much less suicidal than those who didn't have an NDE. And that was counterintuitive to me. So I asked them, what's this all about? Why are you less suicidal now? And they said, basically, when you lose your fear of dying, you also lose your fear of living. You're not afraid of losing your life because you know that what comes afterwards is beautiful. So you jump into life with both feet and take chances you wouldn't have taken before. And you end up finding a much more meaningful and fulfilling life than you had before. There's meaning to everything. There's a purpose to everything you see. And you can enjoy life much more because now that you're free of the fear of dying.
Wow. Well, you know, some wise guy, or girl, I don't know who said it first, said that the difference between spirituality and religion, spirituality is our connection with the divine, and religion is crowd control, right? So,
that's good.
And so one of the great ways of people being controlled naturally, and we see this in the media, we're seeing it in many different ways in our so-called civilization, but fear is a great way to control people. And the greatest fear that we have, other than public speaking, according to Dale Carnegie, the other fear we have is fear of death. And so if you're able to remove that fear of death, all of a sudden, that person's outlook and purview becomes much broader. And in a certain regard, I don't want to sound paranoid, but much more dangerous to the existing power structure, because those people cannot be leveraged things that leverage people. You know, mentioned one more thing that I want to bring up before you respond to this, because it's going to include it. And that is that one of the things that changes that people make, I noticed, is that they become less obsessed with money, power, and fame.
Right.
And more interested in service and connection with other people. So that's pretty extraordinary. Say more about that.
Right. It does change people in a variety of ways. And example is one fellow I knew who was a Marine sergeant. His whole career, his whole goal in life was to become a Marine sergeant. And he did that. And he was in Vietnam leading his platoon into battle, got in a firefight, and was shot in the chest. And he had shrapnel throughout his lungs. So he was air-evac to a hospital in the Philippines. And during the operation there, to clean out his lungs, he had a near-death experience. And when he awoke from that afterwards, he felt He couldn't be a Marine. He couldn't shoot anybody. But he went through rehab and then was sent back into Vietnam and tried to lead his platoon, but he just couldn't do it. He couldn't shoot. And he realized, I can't be a Marine anymore. So he gave up his lifelong goal and quit the Marines, came back to the States and trained to be a medical technician. And I've heard this again and again from people who are in violent careers, people who are career policemen who couldn't go back to the job. I've talked to people who are career criminals who had to give up that life. And it just wreaks havoc in their lives. It's also true of people who are in cutthroat businesses where the job is to get ahead at someone else's expense. They come back from a near-death experience realizing that what you do to someone else, you're doing to yourself. It's basically the golden rule. But they no longer see it as just a guideline to be followed, but as the law of nature, like the law of gravity. When you hurt someone else, you end up hurting yourself. When you help other people, you're helping yourself as well. So some people will quit business and go into some helping profession, or they may stay in business but change the way they do it and treat their competitors and their customers and their employees with more compassion than they ever did before. And that totally changes the way they live their lives and the way their families have to live their lives, which often disrupts the family structure as well.
Exactly. All of a sudden, somebody has a much more expanded view of the universe. And looking at the lesser things that we bother with. I also noticed after that my father was less he was less into trivia. I mean, he was less apt to get these distorted views of things. He was much more open minded. In fact, his open mindedness actually amazed me at various times. And I think that really is one of the great windows. This is a great window to liberation, because so much of our civilization and so on is really about the linearity of things. That things happen in cause and effect, really very, very linear. Again, it's very materialistic. Money is what's important.
Right, right.
And it's so interesting that people return from these experiences not just with an epiphany, but with an epiphany that literally changes the trajectory of their life from that point on. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, we tend to define ourselves by these labels we put on, like I'm a male, I'm 74, I'm a Virginian, I have this religious affiliation, this political affiliation, and so forth. And people find in a near-death experience, they don't have those things anymore. It's just their consciousness and nothing else, and they're better off without it. So when they come back to this life, they're stuck with, what am I doing in this straitjacket I put myself in? This is not meaningful. And they tend to have less sympathy for all these labels we put on each other and on ourselves.
There's one more question that I have, and that has to do with it's kind of the joke they say about people who remember their past lives, and they tend to be like, I was a queen, but weren't you ever like a slave or anything like that? And so with all of these very heavenly experiences, are there people who have experienced the opposite? Have they experienced dire fear in hell? What about those kinds of near-death experiences?
Well, that's a great question, Steve. When we first started doing this research back in the 1980s, we didn't hear any unpleasant experiences. We didn't know they were there. And it turns out that, it's hard enough to talk about a pleasant near-death experience. It's very hard to talk about an unpleasant one. People think, what's wrong with me that I didn't have a blissful experience? Am I an evil person? What did I do wrong? So we did some depth research trying to find these people, and we did eventually find enough to write a good article in a medical journal about the unpleasant experiences. And most researchers have said that between 1 in 5% of people who have a near-death experience have an unpleasant one. But there may be many more than that who just aren't willing to talk about it. And what we see is that, for the most part, the unpleasant experiences sound just like the pleasant ones, but they're experienced in a terrifying way. People will say they feel like they're ripped out of their bodies and thrust down a tunnel into a blinding light, and they're struggling against that, trying to get back into control. And no matter what happens in a near-death experience, you're not in control of it. Someone else or something else is controlling this process. And if you're the type of person that needs to be in control, that is a terrifying experience. And at some point, many of these people who are trying to struggle to get back in control get exhausted trying to make that struggle, and they will just surrender. And as soon as they surrender, it becomes a blissful experience for them. So I suspect that part of what makes these experiences frightening is our resistance to them.
Isn't that interesting? You know, it certainly sounds like the experiences that people have with LSD and other psychedelics, that, again, it's the same thing, the same chemistry that's happening, but it's the interpretation.
Right.
I'm not in control. All of a sudden, I'm in fear. I remember the many years ago when I did that for the first time. Once I was reassured that I was okay, then I went on to experience the experience. But until I got over the fear that I wasn't going to be put back together right, in other words, right? You know, or you're a psychiatrist, you understand that. You know, if somebody, if you're having all of these hallucinations and, you know, life is not a pleasant thing if those things persist.
That's right. Yeah.
You also compared these experiences with actual quote unquote psychotic episodes. What did you discover in that?
Well, there's so many differences between psychotic episodes and spiritual episodes, like near-death experiences, in terms of the context in which they occur, the content. Most psychotic experiences are idiosyncratic, and whereas near-death experiences are consistent from person to person and across cultures and across religions. But I think the biggest difference is how they affect people's lives. Psychotic episodes make people feel diminished. They're frightened by them. They feel more alienated from other people. They feel more introverted, and they don't want to pursue it. Whereas people who have a near-death experience feel much more expansive afterwards. They enjoy looking into it and talking with other near-death experiences about the experience. They feel much more connected to other people, not alienated from them. And they feel like their lives are enriched by the experience, not diminished by them. So it's a totally different type of experience, and the way it affects people is totally different.
You know, one of the things that I noted toward the end of the book, you're talking about not just how near-death experiences impact the people who've had them, but the people who hear about them and read about them. And now that more and more people, since Raymond Moody's book 45 years ago, however long ago that was, more people are exposed to this. So how does it impact people who hear about these? And then finally, how have you been impacted by studying this phenomenon for half a century?
Well, we first saw the, quote, secondhand effects in the families of people who had the experiences, that they sometimes became more spiritual and more loving as well. But there have now been several studies done of college classes who are taught about near-death experiences. And they've done studies sampling their attitudes and beliefs before the class, after the class, and then a year or two after the class is over. And they find that these students are consistently more spiritual and more altruistic in their behavior after a near-death experience class. And I was very encouraged by this. You don't have to almost kill someone to have them improve their lives. So I thought, well, this is one reason why I want to write this book, to share with other people the benefits of a near-death experience and maybe help other people reach this transformation, make them give them a more spiritual outlook towards life without almost killing them.
Yep, that's really a very good reason to proliferate this book. And so are you on a, I know that there's probably not a physical tour these days, but are you getting a lot of interviews and so on?
I am, and the silver lining of the pandemic is that I can do it from home rather than flying all over the country. But I have been doing a lot, and actually I'm enjoying it. It gives me a chance to talk about my favorite topic, and it gives me a chance to explore how it's changed me. As you said, it has changed me as well. I become much more open-minded about things. When I started off as a materialistic scientist, I knew we had all the answers. Now, of course, I realize we don't, and that's fine with me. I believe that after I die, I will have the answers. So what's the rush? I can't say I understand any of it, especially when I know that people are talking to me about it in metaphors rather than concrete terms. But I do believe that there is something after death, and that it's not something to be afraid of.
That's really a wonderful, it's really a wonderful realization to come to in these times, particularly as people, you know, we're living in a much more materialistic time. People are rediscovering these paths and practices, and yes. somehow having this idea that there is something there that is bigger than both religion and non-religion is really it's a heartening thing. So right. I'm really right. hoping that this that you get a lot of play. I saw that you were interviewed by the New York Post. You know, and you know, again, how when you're interviewed by mainstream media, how receptive are people to your presentation?
Well, the ones who choose to interview me are very receptive to it, and the other ones don't talk to me.
That's good. And that's a perfect conclusion. Thank you so much, Dr. Bruce Grayson, my dear old friend from many years ago. I so appreciate your life's work, and I'm certain it's going to make a difference. This is Steve Bamman on WikiPolitiki, and we're back with you again next week. Thank you,
Bruce. Thank you, Steve.